little taste of the brand new song from singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash. We had a chance to catch up with Roseanne last night from her daughter's home in Nashville to talk about the making of the song and the road ahead for this country of ours.
Hi, Rich. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, given the circumstances. You know, one foot in front of the other, one day at a time.
Yeah, same here.
The new song is so powerful, so needed right now. And in your letter, your essay about the new song, you talked about physics. Was it entropy? I wasn't a good science student. Was it entropy, the need for things to fall apart before they can come back stronger?
Is that what it's called? I couldn't remember the word either. I just knew that there was a model that that things have to fall apart first before they come back at a more refined, evolved level. And I just have to believe that's what's happening right now.
I sure hope so. These are such stressful times. The pandemic, the fight for justice for blacks in America, the nonsense coming from the White House, and with that comes, as you said, a sense of isolation and panic. And your response, I guess, is it safe to say your therapy is in the writing?
Well, I would hate to say it was just therapy, because that takes it to that, and it kind of diminishes it in a way, because then it takes it out of the realm of being actual work and craft and art, and you know. But at the same time, doing it is it has an organizing principle as far as my feelings and my thoughts. I mean, a lot of writers have said this, and I totally agree, is that sometimes you don't know what you're thinking or feeling until you write it. And I realized how much outrage and grief I feel right now. It's, you know, and tormented. And I am in a very privileged position. And the suffering that's gone on around me, you know, I think it's pulled at all of us. And trying to find some common humanity, the things that we all believe in, because there's so much division right now. And I know those things are there.
I think, too, of the fact, and you talk about it in your essay, the notion that you or any of us who love our country, but know we haven't yet fulfilled the promise of America completely, the notion that anybody who thinks that way could be viewed as an enemy or unpatriotic is not only ridiculous, but dangerous.
I said in the essay that, you know, my family, both sides of my family, my ancestors fought in the Revolutionary War, and that every generation since then, through the War of 1812 on up, a man has served in the military of my family every generation, and that I feel so rooted as an American and treasure all of those things that are quintessentially American, you know, particularly because of who I am, the music and the art. And so to be vilified as an enemy by 40% of the country, like you said, it's dangerous and insulting, but it's also hurtful. You know, it's like I'm dug in here for centuries.
And I don't know how we got to this place, and maybe it didn't happen just in the last 3.5 years, but how we got to a place in America where you couldn't just disagree with people. You couldn't believe that we were on our way to the same destination, but taking a different path. But now we've reached this place where those who don't agree with those in power are not just wrong, but they are evil.
Yeah, I don't get it. I grew up in a household and in a climate where Republicans and Democrats disagreed respectfully and had conversations that were worthwhile and deep and thoughtful. And even if nobody's opinion changed at the end, they walked away after having raised a glass and shaken hands. I want to see that time come back. You know, it's frightening how much tribalism there is. And what we're missing is community. You know, before my year's worth of concerts got canceled, at the beginning of the lockdown, I was talking about this in concert for the last year about community. I just felt this urgency to find it. And I started saying to audiences, you know, hey, we have created community in 2 hours here. Mm. We can spread it out. We can do it.
Well, I'm hopeful that's still the case here. Now, the words are so incredibly searing, powerful, hopeful, and then John Leventhal, who you know quite well, just crafted such incredible music to propel that message forward.
Yeah, I had written the lyrics to Crawl Into the Promised Land, and, you know, I gave them to John, and the music came really quickly. He knew exactly what to do. And then, you know, because we're in lockdown, we're fortunate to have a recording studio in our basement, and he played everything himself, and my son sang on it. We sent it to Sarah Jarosz, and she sang the high part on it remotely. And it came together so quickly, Rich. And then the record label, I just sent it to them, and they wanted to release it before the election because it's pertinent, you know, it's timely. And I said to somebody yesterday, I said, I can't remember how it happened. I can't remember writing the lyrics. I can't remember how John wrote the music, you know, and that's, kind of a beautiful feeling, like it came out of a deep place.
Well, and how long was it from idea to boom, it's out there for all the world to hear?
I guess I wrote the lyrics in June, and we recorded it. John was in the middle of another project, so when I finally gave him the lyrics, he did that last month, you know, in September. Played it for the label, and they said, we got to get this out before the election. So at the end of September, we were putting this video together. And I think that I really want people to see the video because the images are so powerful, connecting the civil rights movement with the Black Lives Matter movement and the women getting the right to vote with the Women's March, you know, and my mother's pictures in there, my husband, and, you know, it's like the last 50 years or even 100 years of what we've been through as Americans. And it's a beautiful series of images. And my son shot all the footage of me. So this was really a family affair.
And it's, make sure I get it right, Eric Baker and Phyllis Hausen, who did the video work?
Yeah. Yeah, Phyllis is a film editor. Eric is a photo curator, and he actually did the cover for my last album, The River and the Thread, as well.
We're talking with Roseanne Cash here on Downtown. Deliver me from tweets and lies. Man, I love that line. We were talking with Richard Schiff of the West Wing last week, and he brought this up, and God, it rings true. Don't you long for a time when we could go a couple of days without even thinking about who the president is?
Yes.
Wouldn't that be a great relief?
Where the heat is so turned down in the drama that you just assume everybody's doing a good job.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or the focusing on the things that really matter instead of attacking and bullying and the vicious things that come out. It's like, that really doesn't matter. What really matters is how many people are dying right now, you know, and that 545 children have been separated from their parents and the parents can't be found. And these are things that matter, that the EPA has deregulated chemicals that cause damage to fetuses. These things matter, not attacking a journalist.
And I think about this, and I was certainly no fan of, well, really either Bush administration, but I don't know that I ever, until the last few years, questioned whether or not the person in that office on Pennsylvania Avenue cared about the American people. Even with bad presidents, I thought, well, they're doing the best they can. I don't agree with them, but they're trying to do what they think is best, and that is so clearly not the case right now.
No, it's clearly not the case, and I agree with you. I wasn't a fan. I think the Iraq War was a horrible, horrible misstep. But at the same time, like you said, I never doubted that he was a patriot and that he wanted to unify the country. I really believed that, but no matter how I disagreed with some things, that he was interested in governing all Americans. I do not feel that with the current occupant. You know, right now trying to withdraw federal support from what he calls anarchist jurisdictions, that includes, you know, taking care of mothers and babies. That includes all kinds of things that they need money for. I felt like making a T-shirt that says, you know, resident of an anarchist jurisdiction.
Well, it can be an overwhelming situation. And as you point out in the song, it's hard to comprehend it fully in the moment. 50 years away from here, 60 if I run. How do we get it back? How do we get our country back and crawl into that promised land again?
You know, I'm an optimist by nature, and I'm also an optimist by a feeling of responsibility, because I have 5 children. You bring children into the world, and their future is laid out before them, like a field of possibilities. If you're a pessimist as a parent, or you despair, you're taking away that field from them. You're taking away part of their future. So I feel like no matter how worried I am, no matter how much in my private moments I despair, that it's my job to be optimistic for children. And I do believe that we're going to come out of this at that higher level that is modeled in physics. I do. I have to believe that. I can't believe in civil war. I can't believe in the destruction of the American ideal. It's still alive. And it's alive in so many of our imaginations that it has to happen. We have to get there.
I've got a 6-year-old at home. I try to be optimistic for him, and I promise you, I did not teach him this, but when we're out for out driving and we see a Trump Pence sign, he refers to them now as TP signs.
That's so cute.
Out of the mouths of babes. You know, a lot of people have said, and I think I've said this myself in the past, that, oh, Trump is a symptom. But now I the deeper we get into this, I think it's more than that. That, look, there are 2 separate problems, and the urgent matter is getting rid of the single most unqualified person to ever hold that job. And I think it's so important. We know from 4 years ago that we don't get complacent in these last 10, 11 days.
We can't, because you know who actually won the 2016 election? Did not vote.
Yeah.
That is who won the election. Because more people who were eligible to vote didn't vote than did. And that kind of, you know, democracy doesn't work. If you don't vote, democracy does not work. So it's not only important to get registered, but to check your registration. If you're voting by mail, to track it, to see if it was received and, you know, that it was valid, which I've already done. Or vote, if you're voting in person, to get there, you know, prepared to wait in lines, which is voter suppression. I hate that, that they're, you know, people are getting intimidated at polling places and having to wait for 6-8 hours. That shouldn't happen.
Now, I'm encouraged, though, when I see these people willing to wait 6-8 hours to vote and the incredible turnout for early voting. And I hope that bodes well. I hope it means that the people have had enough. And even people who maybe voted that way last time around have said, I need more from my country than this.
I agree. I mean, it is heartening. It's finally people have gotten motivated. You know, I've lived in New York City for 30 years, and we always knew who Trump was. He was always a con man from the beginning. And, you know, he was kind of a joke in New York circles, like, oh, you know, the guy who has this pretense of being a great businessman who but has 3,500 lawsuits against him for non-payment of his contractors and who defaults and declares bankruptcy all the time. It's like, we knew that. So the idea, when he announced he was going to run, I laughed at John. I said, can you believe this? You know, so the whole thing is still an utter shock to me.
Well, if he goes away, though, there are still people who believe in that message, and people with what appears to be an ample supply of hate and anger in their hearts. What happens to them? Do they go back into the shadows because it's no longer safe for them to speak that way and say those words? And is there any way for us to reach them and bring them back?
I don't know. You know, this thing about his economic policies, well, that's BS, because, you know, the tax breaks went to the 1%. Or that he's not afraid to speak his mind. Yeah, but he has no decency when he speaks his mind, and he doesn't care about the norms and all of these careful constructions in our government that are supposed to take care of us, you know, just smashing them left and right and stocking them with loyalists only. But the idea that, like you just said, that there is hatred and violence that was covered up before maybe and is now out in the open, well, maybe it has to be out in the open for it to be healed and cured. And the thing that I keep going back to, Rich, is education. I think that civics is not given enough attention in elementary school, nor is the history of slavery. And I think that if that real history was taught in full, that compassion would be aroused in young children, and a pride in government and an understanding. You know, those things have to be supported, and the public school system is being gutted by the current education secretary. All of it is falling apart, but again, I have to be an optimist.
Well, I teach civics to high school freshmen and teach history.
Do you really? Oh, you're my hero. That's right. I remember this now.
I do, and it's, I mean, on the one hand, it's encouraging, it's hopeful because they want a better future, and you have to be very careful of not being political and explaining that there are two sides and everybody's got their viewpoint, but I'm hopeful because I see in them that they see through some of the showmanship, some of the snake oil salesman that exists there, and I think they're perhaps in some ways more perceptive of that than some of the adults are.
Totally agree, and I'm just so happy you teach civics. That's wonderful. I have a 21-year-old son, and he's incredibly disillusioned right now, but he makes it a point to stay incredibly well-informed. He reads everything, and he's not a Biden fan, but he's going to vote for Biden. You know, he and all his friends were huge Bernie fans, and his point is, I don't want things to change slowly. I want them to change radically. And, you know, he thought Bernie was the guy to do it. I said, he will never be elected, honey. He goes, yeah, we're going to vote for Biden, but, you know, they want radical change. But that's not generally how it happens, is it?
No, no. This was good, though. I asked some of my freshman students, hey, you all know, you're pretty smart. We've talked about this. What are the five freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment? And a good percentage of the class was able to list all five. I said, congratulations, you apparently know the First Amendment better than our next Supreme Court justice.
Now that...
I may have gone too far with that.
No, this could be a very long conversation. So I'll say one thing about that. I have a very dear friend who was a Supreme Court clerk for Justice Brennan. And he's a constitutional scholar. He teaches constitutional law. Well, he's written this op-ed, and it's about to come out as an e-book, about how her nomination violates the religious clause in the Constitution. And that happens to be his specialty. And the reason is because Trump was advised by the evangelical groups and the Catholics who are, what are they called, very conservative, almost extreme Catholics, that's who they wanted. I mean, and this is documented, and he didn't meet with anybody else, right?
It was set up by the Federalist Society that pre-selects all these candidates for those judgeships?
Right, but not just the Federalist this time, but it was a religious thing. So Michael, my friend's point is that this violates the religious clause in the Constitution, and it's unconstitutional that she should be nominated. So I don't think this is going to change anything, but it was fascinating to read specifically citing chapter and verse, no pun intended, of why it's unconstitutional.
Roseanne Cash with us here on Downtown. You wrote a wonderful piece a few months back about being an artist, a troubadour in these strange times, and how you missed the thing that you had wanted to lose How's your relationship with the notion of touring these days?
Like I said, I'm privileged. I really enjoyed being at home during quarantine. I really did. I was burnt out being on the road, you know, and I liked being in my own kitchen, and I liked cooking and wandering around the house. And then suddenly, of course, all of these lyrics started coming because I wasn't traveling every day, and I had time to think, and, you know, my instincts for poetry and rhyme were still there and intact. So that's all been great. The idea that, for me, at my age, that it actually might not happen again makes me really sad. You know, I have dates booked in April, and I keep thinking, how is that going to happen? That probably won't happen in April. And I know venue owners, too, who are saying, I don't think it's going to happen in April, and if it doesn't, we're all going to close, which is heartbreaking. So there's all these initiatives right now, Save Our Stages and, you know, Help for Independent Musicians. Like I said, I'm sad about the idea that it might not ever happen again, but I'm going to have to get used to the idea.
Are people doing a better job in Tennessee than they were back in the spring when it comes to mask compliance and as your daughter found out, not being jerks about it?
Not that I see. You know, I'm in Tennessee right now.
Right.
Because I came down here quarantined for 12 days, then moved in with my daughter. We're waiting for the birth any second now of her baby. And she just, you know, she has not gone anywhere, not inside a restaurant, not inside a store since March. And they try to go to the gardens or to the park, you know, and she gets furious when people don't wear masks. It's just so selfish, you know, walk up close to a 9-month pregnant woman and she has to stop and say, could you please put your mask on? And then they roll their eyes. And not everyone. I can't make generalizations, but definitely it's not like New York where 90% of us are wearing masks all the time.
Well, and again, that goes back to the top. You probably saw the Columbia University study today that if there had been any kind of coordinated federal government response, that might have saved the lives of anywhere between 130,000 and 210,000 Americans.
That brings tears to my eyes just to hear you say that, because, you know, I lost a couple friends. One of my closest girlfriends lost both her parents to COVID, and the unnecessary loss is it's unspeakable. It's just too much to consider. How much grief is rolling in waves across this country, all of those families, and that, you know, more than half of those deaths didn't have to happen.
The proceeds of Crawl Into the Promised Land will go to the Arkansas Peace and Justice Memorial Movement. Can you talk a little bit about what they do?
Well, they are, it's painful what they do. They're, one of their initiatives is to document all the lynchings in Arkansas going back to the early part of the 19th century and to create memorials for each side of lynching. And the beautiful thing that they're doing, I mean, that's beautiful in itself, but is to bring together not only the descendants of those who were lynched, but the descendants of the perpetrators and create a space where they can talk and heal together and be united. I mean, that to me is real reconciliation and reparation, is when those two halves come together. And because my ancestry on my dad's side is in Arkansas, I wanted to do something to give proceeds to something that was related to Arkansas. Because at the same time that I wrote Crawl Into the Promised Land, the lyrics, I wrote this song called The Killing Field. Because the Black Lives Matter movement really deeply affected me, thinking about the racism in the South and the racism of my grandfather, to be honest, and how you can carry those wounds and that toxicity through the generation, and that my father broke the chain of it, but it's up to my generation to go a step further into reconciliation. So that's why I the proceeds go to them.
Well, that sounds like an amazing organization. Well, I'm in a little Twitter bubble, as I guess we all are, and I'm always lifted, even with the tone, when you will sometimes begin the day by asking what fresh hell. But then I remind myself, and this is the solace I take, is that, and I say it to friends, there are more of us. There are more people in this country who believe in doing things the right way, and I'm hopeful that we'll see that play out here in the course of the next 10 days and that we can all lift our head and raise our hands.
Oh, thank you, Rich, for quoting that line. I believe it, too. If you look at the goodness that has come out in people during this really hard time, it's deeply moving. And I believe that is in most of us, like you said.
Well, thank you, as always, for the inspiration that you've given us again with Crawling to the Promised Land. It's always a treat to talk with you, Roseanne. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rich. It's always a treat to speak with you.
And congratulations on the upcoming birth as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's very exciting.
All right.
Hope for the future.
Indeed. All right. Thank you, Roseanne. Be well. Stay safe.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Great Roseanne Cash with us here on Downtown, waiting for that baby to be born and be a grandma. Exciting news there and a wonderful song. Check it out on all the platforms out there, Spotify and the others, and Roseanne's website as well. Crawl into the Promised Land.